I was sipping a cold San Miguel in a Mallorcan bar. It was the 18th of April, 1991, a week into our first family holiday for some time, with Liz, my very patient wife, and Jordan and Bethany, our beautiful little girls. There was nothing to worry about. I'd finished command, left my commander unit, and had weeks of leave to come. I glanced up at the scruffy TV and caught images of a biblical exodus in snow and mountains. None the wiser, I returned to our villa. The Spanish police had called. "Ring Colonel Jonathan Thompson," and Liz started packing. A week later, after a spectacular Chinook flight from Diyarbakir, following the River Tigris, crossing vast plains, gorges and mountains, and over the Syrian border, I was sitting outside a school in Zacco, northern Iraq, involved in a coalition security and humanitarian operation to rescue the Kurds. Operation Haven. At the beginning of March, encouraged by an appeal at the end of Gulf War I from President Bush, Shia Arabs in the south and Kurds in the north mounted uprisings against Saddam. These were put down brutally with harsh reprisals. 500,000 Shia fled into the southern marshes, 1.5 million Kurds into the mountains, into Turkey and Iran. Up to 1,000 Kurds a day were dying. Between 60 to 100,000 Iraqis were murdered. Our first task was to start clearing the main route east from Zacco. By this time, I had a small group of signalers, some Land Rovers, US Marines who could bring down fire support, and two US Cobra attack helicopters. We set off for the first major town, Batoufa. A breathtaking vista. Fertile and green rolling hills on one side, craggy edges of snow-capped peaks on the other. We passed blackened remains of villages. Fields, hilltops, re-entrance and tracks had been mined to prevent Kurds returning. Lone Iraqi tanks would swivel their guns towards us. Our Cobras would rise and posture in response. We stopped at Batoufa, dismounted. It was chaos. Dead bodies lying bloated at the side of the road, clothes strewn, rubbish everywhere. We saw Kurdish Peshmerga, guerrilla fighters, those who meet with death, keen to see whether it was safe enough for their people to return. We approached a group of Iraqi soldiers, scruffy, weather-beaten, tired, menacingly pointing their rifles at us, one with a bayonet fixed. Calming our US Marines down, weapons at our side, with a rocket-propelled grenade pointing at my face, we struck up a conversation with a Shia from Basra in the south. His own regiment had quelled the Shia revolt, and his family had fled to the marshes, his mother killed. We stopped for a picture with them. An old man beckoned and invited us in for sugary green leaf chai. What a relief. In halting English and sign language, he explained that about 20,000 people had fled the town and pointed to an Iraqi barracks up on the top of a hill. We set off, stopping at the bath party station, where the cellars had blood-stained iron bed frames wired up to light sockets for torture. The stench was awful. Arriving at the barracks, our small force of 10 was soon surrounded by Iraqi soldiers, as surprised as we were. The US Marines were not used to our brazen bluff, but kept their composure. I asked them to mount guard and look confident. Two of us were escorted to see the commanding officer in his bunker, Colonel Omal. He had a picture of Saddam, dark, with a moustache behind his desk. I couldn't tell the difference between the two of them. We were offered chai. He spoke English, and we politely mentioned that 4-5 Commando would be clearing this area tomorrow, and that it would be in his interest to take his soldiers and be off by the time we arrived. He said this was impossible, rang up somebody more important, and repeated that it would be difficult. But that night they left. The Kurds had ascended into the mountains and descended into Dante's Inferno, but how would they get out? A week later, we were in Ahmadiyya. Over 2,000 years old, this cliff-top town of 10,000 is captured so atmospherically by Lincoln Row. It sits proudly within the mountains, the only friend the Kurds have. A track lies at the bottom. I followed it one day to see an old man walking his donkey, laden with reed, through the ancient gates of Bab Zabar, built in the 2nd century BC, adorned in Assyrian carvings. At the top were remains of a synagogue, an Aramaic church, with services still held in the ancient tongue, and a mosque. Assyrian Christians, Kurdish Muslims, Jews had all lived together in peace. The first time I strolled into this deserted town, all you could see were shuttered shops and filthy streets. Only the old, infirm and brave families remained, mingling with Peshmerga. As I took this in, an old man shouted, "Me, Christian! Me, Assyrian Christian!" Later, in his house, I was given sweet chai and leavened bread with pear and fig jam, goat yogurt and sesame seed dip. In faltering English, he said that he had been in Palestine with the British Army during the war. One of his sons had died in the Iraq-Iran War, and his other had fought and was now a schoolteacher. They had fled into the mountains 3 weeks ago. They had their house plundered, but not trashed. They'd left the door open and hung a picture of Saddam up in the entrance. On my last visit, his 11-year-old granddaughter presented me with a notebook, a handwritten Arabic, Kurd, English translator. The old man said, "There's been no peace here since 1958, when the British left. Thank goodness you're back." We encouraged survivors to clean the town, knocking on doors and handing out brooms and shovels. We cleaned up with them. Teachers were the most enthusiastic. That was how rebuilding lives began. It was mid-May, and refugees were returning as confidence in security increased. With civilian help, we organised way stations, like pit stops for refugees. At one called Shaladiza, we were setting up with a fireman from Birmingham in charge, when a family of Kurds from Iran were dumped on the road right beside us. The fireman said, "What do we do? We're not ready. I've never done this before." We pointed at a derelict hut with no roof and invited the Kurds to rest there, showing them the spot where they could dig latrines. I said to the fireman, "Do your best and I'll be back in a week." I returned with an American ambassador called Joseph LeBaron to be met by the smiling fireman who was looking after a sea of tents and Kurds, all organised into proper areas, sanitation facilities up. He said that this was the most fulfilling thing he'd ever done in his life. He turned and beckoned, "Walk this way. I want to show you something." We strolled to the derelict hut and were invited in by the elder to visit the family we'd met the week before. The hut had a wriggly tin roof propped up by wooden pillars. It was spotless, rugs on the floor, the family smiling, the daughters in colourful clothes, dignified and humble, despite having lost nearly everything. A meal was laid out for us that we tried to refuse. Tea, bread, jam, and dolmades. Joseph conversed in Farsi, listening to their story. The patriarch spoke English. He reminded me of the time when the RAF bombed Kurdish tribes, the first example of strategic bombing. "Do you remember what Churchill said in 1921? That if we don't solve the Kurdish problem now, it will come back to haunt us. I realized that nobody forgets anything. Amidst profuse thanks, we bade an emotional farewell, with Joseph barely able to hold back the tears. A couple of days later, we went to Peshmerga Regional Headquarters to see a guerrilla leader called Hussein Sinjari from the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, one of two Kurdish political groupings. He greeted us, tanned, piercing dark eyes, black hair cut like a monk at the front, a moustache curled up at the sides, a long black robe, Kurdish dagger in a large colourful sash around his waist. He was like a cross between Dali and Lenin. He immediately set about impressing on Joseph the need for American help, security, political recognition, the abolishment of the notorious Mu'arabat, the Iraqi intelligence service. A good result for the Kurds meant semi-autonomy, a bad one more violence and another exodus, he asserted. This dialogue continued over lunch with a colourful gathering of all opposition parties to Saddam, including Turkmen and Assyrian Christian communists. All were united in one thing. We must overthrow Saddam. The next day, my last in Ahmadiyya, finished with a discussion on reconstruction with an Indian civil servant outside a food distribution warehouse. We asked each other, after all of this, how do you rebuild a country? How do you introduce a currency? How do you help people get back to normal? And what if Saddam comes back?